This is the Transcend in Life podcast with your host, J.M. Ryerson, taking you from fear to freedom.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Transcend in Life. You guys are in for a treat today. Mark is the author of The Career Toolkit, Essential Skills for Success That No One Taught You. Educated at MIT, Mark has spent his career launching and fixing new ventures at startups, Fortune 500s, and academia. He's developed new software languages, online marketplaces, new authentication systems, and tracked criminals and terrorists on the dark web. Mark helped create the Undergraduate Practice Opportunities Program, MIT's Career Success Accelerator, where he's taught for 20 years. Mark also serves on the board of nonprofits, Techie Youth, and Plant a Million Corals. Mark, you have an interesting background, brother. I can't wait to hear about it. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Truly, it is my pleasure, and I'm looking forward to it. So tell me how we get to here, because you've tracked criminals on the dark web. You've written a book. We have some interesting ways to go with the first question, but why don't you just kind of give me an idea of how you got to this place?
Yeah, I have kind of an interesting bifurcated career. My primary career began as a software developer in the 1990s. I came out of MIT during the dot-com era, and I started doing tech startups. And very quickly, because of both my own interest and where I wanted to go and my skills, I moved into leadership roles. And I became a CTO, and I've built a number of organizations. And technology has let me go from one industry to another. With my background in cryptography, that's why I did my graduate work at MIT, and I was able to go into cybersecurity, and of course that touches upon some stuff on the dark web, which led to some interesting paths there. Now, at the same time, something happened about 21 years ago. I was interviewing people, and I would ask them questions in their domain about software or marketing or whatever they do, and they'd give me the right answer. But then I would ask, what makes someone a great teammate? What do you look for in a leader? And I would get blank stares. And I realized we don't teach this to people. I only learned it because I said, well, if I want to be a leader, I should understand this. But really, all of us should understand it, no matter where we want to be in our careers. So I set out to learn what tools were out there, how I developed my own people. And I happened to hear that MIT was developing a similar program. So I reached out and said, oh, I hear you're working on this. I've been addressing this issue. What can I do to help? And so I said, oh, well, please help us. Let's figure out what we want to teach and how. And then after helping them develop it, they said, hey, why don't you come help us teach? Because although we have some great professors, right, world-class professors at Sloan School of Engineering, getting that practical experience from the field would be valuable. So they brought in myself and others like me, and we co-teach along with the professors. And I've been doing that for 20 years, and it led to the book and a lot of other side interests and hobbies I have.
Well, you obviously, I mean, MIT, you say that, and it's just kind of stops me in my tracks. Like, okay, we're talking to some pretty darn bright people here. But you talked about real world experience, and that's really what it sounds like this book is. It's like, this isn't academia. This is really, you're trying to get to some emotional questions, it sounds like, but tell me a little bit more about the book. What's so unique about this book opposed to some of the others out there? Or maybe there's just a big gap when it comes to finding the right people for your team. Tell me more about that.
Well, let's start with a kind of preference question. Ask yourself, has anyone ever said to you, networking is important? We've all heard that, right? We've all heard, oh, this is an important skill. You have to build your network. Everyone tells us it's important. Now think back, when did someone say, and here's how to do it? If everyone tells us this is so important, why are they not actually teaching it to us? And that's true of all the skills. So within the book, I break it down to three sections. Section one, it's career skills. So it's first how you create a career plan. I've seen so many people say, I want to get to this level, whether it's building their own company or getting to some executive job or some higher up job, but they don't know how do I lay out that path. They just hope I work hard and get there one day, and hope is not a plan. Chapter two focuses on skills. We all have our domain skills, but knowing how to manage your manager, knowing how you're adding value at work, dealing with corporate politics. These are important skills to be effective. Chapter 3, interviewing. Now, this is a kind of surprising one. We've all learned about interviewing. There's plenty of content how to interview, how to answer these tricky questions. But most of us are involved in interviewing other people. And at no point has anyone actually trained us how to do this. I've met executives. They've hired scores of people, hundreds of people. No one ever taught them how to do it. How do we know we're effective at this if we're just going off of, well, I think I'll wing it? Then the second section, leadership and management skills. And it's not about, oh, here's the Six Sigma way to do it or the Agile or whatever. What are the fundamental skills we need, no matter what process, no matter what role? Where these fundamental skills are going to help us, not just as we're executives, not just when we're sitting at the front of the table, but anywhere at the table. How can we employ these skills? Because all of us, if you've worked with a coworker, you've managed a coworker, right? You've had to figure out how to make things happen. And then the third section, communication, negotiation, networking, and ethics. And what makes this book different, there's obviously books on any one of these topics, but all these skills reinforce each other. A good leader knows how to negotiate. A good negotiator knows how to communicate. A good communicator understands how to think about process and some management steps to get buy-in. These things all reinforce each other. And so by looking at it holistically, we can be more effective.
Yeah, it is interesting because so often you hear it out in the real world, which is they don't teach this in college. It's like, you go to school, you get your degree. Again, you got one from a pretty esteemed, you know, alumni. So that's the good news. The challenge is how, like you said, nobody said, here's how to network. So how did you go about this, brother? This is just what you learned. Is it really you reaching out to people around that you felt were really good at it? Talk to me about the process of gathering this book and really putting it on paper, because I think that's where people can glean so much from it to say, you know, he really did dive in and he found from the best experts around the world when it comes to networking, when it comes to interviewing.
These were all skills that I have to admit I was terrible at one point or another, because no one taught me and I stumbled a lot. Now, I recognized in my own career, the one thing I kind of figured out on my own was that career planning piece. I knew I wanted to become a CTO, but then I looked and said, well, being a CTO doesn't just mean I'm really good at creating software. Okay, I'm pretty good at writing code, but I know there's more to it. I have to know how to hire people. I have to know how to work with the marketing team. I have to know how to lead and inspire people. There's all these skills, and I've never been taught this. So I went out, I started learning about it. And some of that came from back then, the internet wasn't quite as robust as today in terms of content. We didn't have podcasts. So I went out, I read a whole bunch of books, scores of books on these topics. I spoke with experts. I fortunately, because I then became good at networking, got to know wonderful people like Olivia Fox Caban, who wrote The Charisma Myth. Great book on here's how you can actually be charismatic. Turns out you can learn that skill just like you can learn leadership or negotiations or golf or anything. And so I began to develop these skills, even teaching at MIT, because I've been fortunate to be teaching with so many other wonderful people. I've learned from that process. I continue to develop every year in my own skills. And I do have on my website, I list all the books I reference in mine, plus a number of other books that I don't necessarily reference, but they were helpful in my development. So other folks can see many of these ideas. It wasn't, oh, I thought of this all by myself. I learned from other great people. And here are the references if you want to go deeper.
I love that. So it sounds like you dove in, you just accumulate all this information. And again, I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, guys, but it sounds like you condensed it into one version. Because truth is, most people aren't going to read as much as you probably did to arrive at this place. Is that the idea, is to take all those, simplify it, and really give tangible takeaways for the reader to be applicable immediately?
That's true. And there's two interesting components to this. So first, I've worked in media before. Books have this interesting history. We've probably all read books where we say, you know, that was about 30 pages of content and then 150 pages of fluff. And the reason is historical. It's that books had to have a certain spine width, right? They had to sit on the shelf and you had to look across the room and go, oh, there's the book I want. And so if you were less than about 130, 140 pages, you were too thin. And so people had to pad their books. And so I really do think there's a lot of content that, hey, 40 pages of great content, and then the rest is fluff. So by combining them together, I was able to get rid of some of the fluff on the topics. But then the other key thing, you know, I would love to go into more detail on some of the things I have in the book, but the most important thing you can get out of this book, it is about a shift in mindset. So what do I mean by that? If you think about leadership as that means you're at a certain role, you have other people reporting to, positional leadership, then you say, well, in my 20s, I'm not a leader, but one day I'll get promoted and then I'll start being a leader. If you recognize that leadership is influential, leadership is not, I get to tell you what to do because of my position, but it is from anywhere on the table, you can say, I have an idea, I'm going to propose it, I am going to convince other people we should do this. That's true leadership. And when you recognize that, your leadership journey doesn't begin once you get the title, and then you have to figure it out when people are looking to you as a leader. It begins today. And so all throughout your career, you find opportunities to practice and develop your leadership, and you will develop much faster. And this is true of our communications, of our negotiations. People think of negotiations as, I do it once every 3 years when I take a new job. I negotiate probably about every week. I negotiate with my coworkers, right? All right, who's going to work on this piece of the project? How do I convince you? No, you do have to let me have a say on what you're trying to decide there. These are negotiations. And once you start to recognize this, you develop faster.
Yeah, man. And you already got at one of my questions, because I love what you said about influential leadership and the whole mindset shift. I love that. I want to dive into the first part, though, the career plan. If I'm listening, and you know how it feels when people are like, they're looking for their career. I've heard so many people, even in their 40s, when I grow up, my career will be. So how do they even start with a career plan, brother? How where do you even start to say, this is what my plan should look like? Do you have some advice that you can give to really help people find what they're looking for? Because I think that's the first step. So many people they're just searching for, who am I and what should I be doing?
It begins with questions. I've got the questions in the book. They're also available as a free download on the website. And they're questions such as, what are things I enjoy doing? Right? Do you love sitting in front of spreadsheets making models, or is that your idea of torture? Do you want a job that's very 9-to-5 and structured? Do you want something flexible? What do you want in your life? Where do you want to live? Because if you want to be the king of Wall Street and you want to live in Iowa, you have a problem, right? Very few people can actually pull that off. And really only Warren Buffett is the one example that comes to mind, not quite Iowa, right? So we have to think about our life as well as our career. So it's not just career questions, but life questions. So we start with these questions. You don't necessarily know how to answer all of them, but answer what you can. Think about not just for today. Certainly if you're 23, you know, the idea, I knew people like, oh, I'll be a consultant. Well, I'll be a road warrior. Just flying around the country at 23, back when we could actually fly, that seemed like a great lifestyle. But when you're 43 and have kids at home, that's not so great. So think about what your life wants to be going forward. Once you have these questions, or at least some answers to them, start talking to people. Talk to everyone you meet. What do you do? What's interesting about that? What do you like? What don't you like? Tell me about what your day-to-day job is like. And for those who are younger, I say, well, I don't know lots of people. Certainly if you're in college or recent grad, you have your alumni network, or you have people you know who might know people and say, you know, I really would like to meet a CFA because I think that sounds interesting. I don't know exactly what it is. I read about it online. Do you know a CFA? Can you introduce me? I'd love to have coffee with this person. And then you start listening and hearing, are there patterns? Am I hearing people, let's say I talk to a lot of people in sales and business development, and what they talk about, oh, I'm always meeting new people. It's always new customers, always trying to help them solve their problems. That sounds interesting. Okay, so now this is sounding like a direction I might want to go in. Let me look what type of sales or biz dev roles are there. And so that's how we can begin to develop our path and find a direction.
All right, so we find the direction, and one of the things you talk about is learning beyond your role in your job to really optimize your job, I think is what it was called, is job optimization. What does that mean, learning beyond your role?
So many people at companies, big and small, they say, okay, I sit here, let's say I'm a software developer, right? I know how to create these buttons and deploy stuff online. And, oh, we have a marketing team over there, and I know they do marketing stuff. Okay, what's marketing stuff? Well, they create our website, and I think we run some ads, so they do that. And that's about it, right? They can give you a two-sentence answer. They don't understand what is it that marketing is doing and how is marketing delivering value, and how is what you are doing as a software developer helping marketing to do their job? How is accounting helping you to do your job? How do the different pieces within your organization fit together? Who's delivering the most value, right? Even understanding, are you a marketing-driven company, a technology-driven company, a sales-driven company? This is important to understand because it changes how you and your unit interact with some of the other units there. We can go beyond that and look at our ecosystem. Do you understand who your suppliers are, who your customers are? How are you taking what your suppliers give you, adding value, and then delivering that value to your customers? Can you recognize a customer from a lookalike who would not be a good customer? Once we understand this, then we can start to say, well, going forward, here's how we can add more value to the customers. If you can deliver more value to your customers, you're delivering more value to your company, and you are going to be a much more important person with a brighter future in your organization.
So I'm guessing, just because your ability to ask questions is incredible. I mean, it's quite literally every answer you've had has been really, really smart questions. So we're going to get into the interview part, because you're right. We were taught how to answer certain questions. But what are the right questions to be asking in an interview? As the interviewer, as we're asking questions, what are we really trying to ask? And what are we trying to ascertain from the interviewee as we're asking these questions?
It begins by defining what the role is. And now most of us, we've seen a job description. We can write up a job description that says, okay, you need to do X, Y, Z. You need to know bookkeeping, how to close the books every month. Okay, pretty straightforward. Maybe how to use this accounting software. Great. One of my favorite pet peeves is in so many job descriptions I see, it says strong leadership and communication skills. Okay, what does that mean? Right? Because there's a difference between leading a team of five people versus leading a team of 500. There's a difference between I need to communicate to other people in finance versus I also need to work closely with sales versus I need to work with our customers, or I need to be an external facing person. So as a CTO, we think about I build software, but in some of my companies, I'm also very external facing. I need to go out and be at conferences and explain to people what we do, sometimes in non-technical terms. That's a different type of communication. So first we have to define what that role is, and really, what does communication mean? Right? What do each of these aspects mean? And then we need to ask questions designed to say, how does this person's communication skill, how does his stack up against hers and other candidates? So we want to break down what those attributes are we're looking in someone, and then design questions to elicit an evaluation in each of those specific attributes.
Do you have some stock standard questions that you're like, man, I wish everybody would ask these questions because they really could get to know who this person is faster? And I know it's not a perfect science, but you know, some behavioral interview questions can help, I think. Are there a couple that you use to really get to know someone, not just get the stock standard answer back from them?
There are some. The only one I want to kind of give away generally, because otherwise it undermines some of my ability to interview folks. I mean, it's not like it's a secret, but when people can look it up online, it definitely lets them prepare a little better. I always like to start with, tell me about yourself. Now, this is a very broad question. It's intentionally broad because what you choose to say And what you don't choose to say tells me a lot about you. Most people will give some overview of their career. How much detail do you go into? What are the jobs you focus on or maybe skip? You might not get into all the details. That's fine. Some people talk about their personal life as well. What is it you're including or maybe not including? And that's going to tell me a lot about what's important to you. And when we interview, it's important to look at this kind of meta question, right? It's not just, okay, what you've told me, but how you're telling me and what you're not telling me.
That's interesting. And as you're talking, I'm looking at the next question. It just struck me. What is mental diversity? I think I know what the answer is, but now I got to ask you, what are you looking for in that? What is that question all about?
Mental diversity. And so I want to define three classes of diversity. There is traditional diversity, that we should not just be all white men sitting around the table in the office. We get an advantage. We know heterogeneous teams outperform homogeneous teams. Having people of different gender, race, religion, cultural background really adds to our ability to perceive problems. And it does so because certainly our customers are not going to be all white men, right? We want them to be represented. And our customers, even if they're companies, are staffed with diverse people. So that's classic diversity. And I want to emphasize, I certainly don't mean to take away from that. People have spoken about neurodiversity. This is a growing term where they talk about people with different mindsets. Classically, people who are dyslexic, or people, the kind of classic quant, right? That genius who's incredibly analytical. We certainly have these folks at MIT. Their social skills may not be as strong, right? We kind of look at them and say, I don't think I want to go out for a beer with this person. But they are a genius at creating these quantitative algorithms. That's neurodiversity. Now, mental diversity, this comes from a colleague of mine, and he uses this term. And it comes from the fact that we all think differently. And it's recognizing that we think differently. And it's the fact, now, I tend to be quantitative. That should not be surprising, given where I went to school and multiple STEM degrees. I'm a very quantitative person. I like to put things in terms of numbers. I like charts. I like graphs. I like formulas. There are plenty of people where if I start out saying, okay, well, let's think about by this formula, I've lost them, right? They think about the world differently. And so I have to recognize, you know, they have a different style. And if we can bring in some of that style, then we're going to be, again, diverse in our thinking. And there's lots of different ways to look at this. Classically, we think about left brain and right brain people, but you can really look at this through any lens. But getting those different ways of thinking can elicit more solutions and more creative options at your organization.
Well, I will say, for those that have experienced CTOs, this guy he can go both ways, guys. He could do sales, he can do technology. Clearly, you have the ability to communicate across both forms, which is amazing. I want to get into leadership and management, because we talk a lot about leadership. And one of the questions you have in here is, what's the relationship between leading and following? And you already talked about influential leadership, which, again, if you were to put a gun to my head, definition of leadership is influence to me. So I'm curious on this, what is the relationship between leading and following?
I'm gonna tell your listeners to pause for a second, because I want you to do this exercise at home. So I want you to come up first, pause, and create the list of what are the attributes that you want in a leader, right? If you're saying, who do I want to follow along, what are these attributes? So pause it for a second, write those down. Okay, now you've got that list written. Now I want you to imagine you're a leader and you're told by a CEO, you know, you get to pick five people for your team for this project. I want you to write down, what are the attributes you want in the followers? So pause for a second and write that down. Okay, now hopefully you've written down both the leadership attributes and the follower attributes. And now here's the big reveal. So if you haven't paused by now, this is your last chance to do it. When you look at these lists, you're going to notice they are extremely similar. The attributes we want in one are often attributes we want in the other. And I've done this many times with people, and they are usually about 90, 95% the same. And usually if you say, well, what about this one? They go, oh, yeah, yeah, we could put that on the other list as well. And so this is helpful to understand in that if we want to be a leader, we can develop these skills even as a follower. Likewise, even if we say, you know, I never want to be a leader, I want to be an individual contributor. And that's a fantastic role. And for many people, that is the right role. But you can still develop leadership skills to be more effective in your follower, in your individual contributor role.
How can people continue to improve on their leadership daily? Because again, I think it's an ever-evolving thing. You never arrive as a leader. It certainly would be my take. So how is it that somebody, you talked about a plan with a career, what would be an idea for a leadership plan to really continue to develop as a leader?
What I'm about to say applies to all of the skills in this book. We have traditionally learned through a lecture-based model. When we think about high school and college, we have someone with knowledge standing at the front, and they're spewing out that knowledge, and we're copying it down in our notebooks as fast as we can. And that's fine. That works very well. I don't mean to knock that model. It's a similar model right now. It's the same thing. I am giving ideas to a whole bunch of followers or a whole bunch of listeners in a very non-interactive way. It's unidirectional. Books are the same thing. When we look at these skills, this is not knowledge, right? Knowledge is, here are the accounting updates for the last year. I'm going to share that knowledge, 1, 2, 3. Leadership, however, isn't, oh, do 1, 2, 3 and you're a leader. There's no formula for networking. Communication isn't just, well, always say this and it works, right? These are complex situations. There's no one right way to do it. Now, we have a model for how to learn this. How we teach it at MIT, it's how business schools have taught this for years. Business schools who do teach leadership and do teach negotiation and do teach many of these skills, they say, look, it's not the professor just telling you what to do. We're going to create a group of people, and they're going to be a former teacher, a former consultant, a software developer, a marketer, different people from different backgrounds. We're going to put you together, and we're going to talk about ideas and situations, and then you're all going to share your thoughts, and you're all going to approach it differently, and from that, you're going to get a much richer idea of how you can approach these problems. You're going to build out the solution set, all the different components you can use. So what can we as individuals do if we're not in business school, if we're not doing this? We can replicate this. What you can do is create your own peer learning group. Now, you can do this within your company. You can do this with friends. You can do this by starting a meetup group or other type of group that's designed to help with these skills. I recommend doing it in small groups of about 6 to 8 people. But on the website, I have another free download, how you can create this. You can do it in small groups. You can do it in larger groups. I talk about how to do it at each size. What you want to do is take content. So you can take a book and say, we're going to read parts of this book. Think of it like a reading group. We're going to read this chapter. Then we're going to discuss it. We're going to discuss these ideas. And I want to be clear. Yes, you can do it with my book. And certainly in the download, I even explain, here's how to break down the book. But it doesn't have to be my book. Pick your favorite business book. Right? Go find a top 10 bestsellers and do that with your group. You can just say, you know what, we're going to listen to this podcast every week and we're going to discuss it every week. Use that as your starting content. It doesn't matter what the content is. You can use mine, but you can use other content. But if you create these learning groups and you discuss it and get these multiple perspectives, it will help develop your leadership. It will help develop these other skills. Because as you point out, there's no clear endpoint. There's no clear, I've now mastered it. It's also the type of thing when we've learned these other skills, when they bring in, oh, we're all going to be using Excel macros starting next week. So we're all going to take a class on Excel macros this week. And then we go, great, now I know the commands. Next week I start using it. There's a very clear applicability. No one says to you, hey, by the way, next week you're going to be leading. Not this week, but yeah, Tuesday at 3, start leading. Right? It's going to just happen kind of continuously. And by having this group such that you're constantly revisiting these topics on a regular basis, they stay top of mind and help you identify when leadership opportunities, communication challenges, networking opportunities, when these things come up, They'll help you recognize and capitalize on them.
So I love that idea. And obviously, communication, networking, leadership, these are all skills that you can do with this group. My question would be, do you welcome and invite feedback? And is there a level of permission that you give the group to say, look, here's why I'm doing this. I really want to get feedback from you. And the reason I ask this is because so often that unsolicited advice just goes over like a lead balloon, but that's really what they need to hear in order to get better. So talk to me a little bit about that within this group, because I think that's where people can really get their bang for their buck by doing what you're talking about.
And I get into this in the download about what are the ground rules for the group? What, you know, is it about getting feedback? Are there certain things we shouldn't talk about? Maybe certain examples. If you're doing this at your company, maybe the rule is we only use examples from outside the company, because you don't want to say, yeah, I was talking to this real jerk in procurement the other day. I was like, okay, yeah, I know that jerk. That might not be a good experience for the organization. So you might set rules. And certainly feedback, I think absolutely feedback should be included. And in fact, that you have this formal group, I think your point is right. Most of us say, oh, by the way, a little feedback on your leading yesterday. I just want to tell you, you know, here's how you can improve it. Whoa, I was blindsided. But of course, when we have these classes, when we do it at MIT, when we do it in business schools, everyone's there to say, well, yeah, I'm here to learn. I'm in this mentality of, I know I don't know. I hope someone can tell me. And when you walk into this group, you have this mentality, you have this permission of, I'm here to get feedback. I'm here to say, I don't know. It's acceptable in this group and people can share. And it doesn't mean you have to do what everyone tells you to do. It may or may not feel right for you, but we're all more open and we recognize feedback shared in this group is given with well intentions and it's well-intended feedback. And you know, we're going to take it as such.
So I want to circle back to the networking thing, because you said earlier, we all know networking is important, but who taught you how to do it? What are some of the just 101, these are the things that you should do when networking, and here's possibly how to be more comfortable networking, because I think we'd all agree it is important, and it's not exactly what you know, but rather who you know. So talk to me about this idea of networking and how people can really get more comfortable and get better at it.
I go into a lot of mechanics of it in the book, but here's the key takeaway. Networking is about relationships. And all of us have had successful relationships. By relationship, I don't necessarily mean dating. It means friendships. It means people we know, we like to see. Too many people think of networking as, okay, I need to go network, so I'm going to go collect a lot of business cards. I'm going to go work the room, and in 20 minutes, you'll see, I'm going to have 10 business cards. And to me, collecting business cards or adding people on LinkedIn, saying someone you've added on LinkedIn is in your network, that's like saying someone who swiped right on you on Tinder is your significant other. Right? That's really what it is. It's, oh, look, we clicked, boom, we're in a relationship. Right? We all know that's not true. Now, how do you take the person who swiped right on you on Tinder and create that relationship? Well, you get to know them, right? You talk to them. You actually go out. Now, for Tinder, it would be formal dating. Here, it's not dates, but you get to know the person. So whether you're added on LinkedIn or you've got the card, start to get to know the person. And just like in our personal romantic relationships, it begins with take an interest in the other person. What matters to them, and get to know them and spend time with them. And now it might not be for dating, it might be on a weekly basis for your professional relationships, probably not weekly, but we do want to reach out and we do want to connect and spend time and build that relationship over time. And when you shift that mentality, when you go from, look at me, I got 30 business cards this week, to, you know what, I met someone this week, we connected, we got to know each other. I think this is going to lead somewhere. I don't mean like, oh, I'm going to get this sale or get this job. It's, this is someone who I'm going to reach out to again, and we're going to build this relationship over time. Far more valuable than 30 business cards.
Is that as simple as just following up with a phone call, asking them to go for coffee? I mean, obviously in the virtual world, it is slightly different than it used to be. Hey, let's go grab a beer after work. But what are you seeing right now as the best way to just, all right, I did connect with this person. I want to follow up. Is it an email? Is it a text? Is it what's kind of protocol today?
It depends on the nature of how you met. But if you want to talk about today, especially in COVID times, now COVID has been obviously a horrible situation we all wish never happened, but there are some silver linings. And here are two of the silver linings. The first is we all have a little more time, right? We all used to spend the mornings commuting. All of us spent at least 30 minutes going somewhere. So imagine if you take the 30 minutes each morning and you say, okay, every Wednesday, I'm going to do coffee with someone, obviously a virtual coffee. And you just reach out and you say to someone you met a year ago, hey, listen, while we're in COVID, I've just been trying to keep in touch with people. And so every Wednesday morning from 8:30 to 9, I do a virtual coffee. Let me know if you're free one of the next Wednesdays. And so we can use this time to reach out and foster those relationships. And certainly reaching out now to people, because we know everyone's at home, it's a little easier to do. It's a little easier to do the outreach. You can always begin with, how have you been, right? How are things going with COVID? We know everyone's been affected. And here's the other advantage to what's going on. Networking is typically local. We typically say, hey, let's grab a coffee. It's a lot easier for me to do with people in New York, where I live, than people in Vegas or Chicago. And in 2019, if I reached out and said, hey, friend in Vegas, let's go hop on a video and catch up for an hour. They would have first said, how do we do that, right? And this is weird. But now, right, this is totally normal. And so whereas most of our networking is local, and if the vaccine works, and I hope it does, I hope it's long-term and we get enough herd immunity, we're all going to be out this summer away from our computers every minute saying, I just want to be outside with people and not have to look at my computer screen. But for now, let's make the most of this time to say, I am going to reach out to people who I can't see locally. I'm going to reach out with people outside of my city, outside of my country, and foster that relationship while I can. Because I don't know how much longer people are going to be happy to sit on a computer screen.
I love what you said, just taking that half hour, which turns into an hour per day that you really could be doing something productive rather than, you know, your nose in, on a windshield or, you know, in a book. You actually can be connecting with the human being. I got to ask on the negotiation thing, just because I'm about to go negotiate with my 11-year-old to make sure he's doing his homework. So negotiating, what are some of the base principles? Because you hear win-win, or people think of negotiation as somebody wins, somebody loses. What's kind of your overall thought on negotiating, and what should be the outcome? What is the hope? Is it a win-win? Does that make sense to you?
Win-win, it's unfortunately become a little trite. I think it's the right idea, but I want to express it differently. I quote in the book the world record home run hitter, Sadahara Oh. He's a Japanese baseball player. And he said something that really changed how I looked at negotiations. He said, when he was asked, how do you hit so many home runs? He said, I look at my pitcher as my partner in this process. Now, when you first think about that, you say, well, the pitcher is literally on the opposing team. And I know that pitcher does not want to see you hit a home run. So we know the pitcher very much wants a different outcome. But still, he said, I am going to look at it this way. I'm going to change my mindset. And by doing that, he said, opened up his ability to see more home run opportunities. Now, when you negotiate with someone, it is very important. And I use this term in the book. I talk about your negotiating partner. Because even though you might be on opposite sides, that mentality of you are my negotiating partner, because together we both want this to work. If you didn't want it to work, you wouldn't even sit down at the table with me. So we are partners in trying to create something. And yes, I would like to get some value, and so would you. And we have to recognize negotiation professor Larry Susskind, who wrote the book Good for You, Great for Me. He talks about the concept of value creation versus value claiming. So as we sit down together, there's a value creation. How do we enlarge that pie, which as we use some of the tactics, we can find ways to make the pie bigger. And then, okay, how am I going to slice up the pie so I can get a really big slice? And it doesn't mean I have to divide it equally between you and me, but certainly if I can make the pie bigger, then, well, even if I'm getting a bigger piece, you're still winding up with more. So it's thinking about both you are my partner in this, and then it's also thinking about how do we do value creation and value claiming and shifting between those two states.
Yeah, that is even a mindset shift right there. I mean, it takes it from such an adversarial idea to more, we're advocates in this. We are going to negotiate a partnership, whatever that looks like, instead of it being, I'm going to win, you're going to lose. Because of the, one of the things we'd love to ask on this is books. And you said you've read a lot. I'm just curious. Three of the most impactful books that you've ever read that have really shaped your professional career, that have really changed your mindset?
Let's see. I would say Keith Ferrazzi's Never Eat Alone. It's a good book on networking. It's not a here's how to network the way mine and some others are written. It's more partly his life story and anecdotes, but I found it very interesting. I think Olivia Fox Caban's book they mentioned earlier, The Charisma Myth, and recognizing I'm an introvert by nature and recognizing that I didn't think I'm not good with people, but I can be, right? And recognizing that I can be. And in fact, even once I learned that, it opened up the possibilities for me to realize these other skills were also learnable. I think that probably had a really big impact on me. And in terms of other books, you know, a recent one I read was Deborah Tannen's Talking 9 to 5. And so I've become a fan of linguistics, a big fan of my friend Valerie Friedland. She's got a book coming out in a few years, and just hearing about how language has evolved, hearing about how we talk. And in Deborah Tannen's Talking 9 to 5, she really looks at gender in the workplace. And it's become really interesting to understand how we communicate differently and what are some of the subtle things that cause us to misperceive each other. So some of the classic examples from this are, we've heard of mansplaining. There's someone, a friend of mine, just started using the term manterruptions. Men interrupt women more often. But in fact, there are cultural norms in this that's okay for men to interrupt. And when we see men interrupting other men or women, they don't pay a social penalty. We don't say, well, that person's a jerk. If they do it too much, yes. But there's a certain level where you say, oh, they're being a leader, they're being aggressive, they're being alpha. If we see women exhibiting the same behavior, because it violates our social norms of how women should behave in general, societal norms, even in the workplace, we say, oh, yeah, she's a little aggressive, right? Or other pejorative terms. And we first have to start by recognizing there are these double standards. And once we recognize that, we can be more aware and start to say, oh, you know what? I did feel a little off because she did that, but I understand why. And no, I'm going to overrule that initial thought and realize she is behaving just like he does. She should not be penalized for that.
It is interesting. Our cultural biases, they're still there. There's these, double standards, or the way, you know, males are supposed to act this way, females, is that's just so hardwired in our society, I guess, that it's still there. And what you're saying is that we're starting to recognize, hey, be aware, this is a thing. Similar to you saying earlier, you know, some of the most dynamic speakers I have seen are quote unquote introverts. And so the whole misnomer that introverts are meek and they don't talk, and that's just not true any longer, that some of the most incredibly gifted speakers, such as yourself, I guess would rather are not extroverts necessarily, but they're incredible communicators. I guess it's more of a statement, not really a question, but it's so interesting how so much of this is coming to light and shifting, hopefully, our mindsets on it.
Well, here's how to think about introverts and extroverts. The technical definition, I believe, this is not my area of expertise, is not about, you know, are you the outgoing, fun guy at the party, or are you the quiet person? It's where we get our energy. And extroverts get their energy being around other people, being out in the bar, being at the party, and feeling, oh, there's lots of people around me. and many of them have been suffering a lot the past few months. Introverts find that draining, and it's by, okay, I'm going to take some quiet time by myself that I get energy. Now, I can tell you, I host a lot of events, or at least I used to. I used to have parties in my house, social events, about every 2 months, and I'd have 40, 50 people in my apartment. After a couple hours, oh my God, this is draining. And I love having them there, and it's fine. And when these parties used to go on for 5 or 6 hours, wow, that was tiring. I'd actually sneak away, check out my doorman. Always would bribe my doorman by bringing down some food and drinks. And, you know, I could get away for 5 minutes. There's 40 people in my apartment, and I'm downstairs with the doorman talking one-on-one for 5 or 10 minutes because I needed that away time. And so, yes, I'm an introvert by that definition, but I'm hosting these parties. I'm putting lots of people in my apartment. I'm going to events, and I'm standing on the stage because what is an introvert versus what are the actual behaviors are separate things.
Yeah. Well, brother, I didn't even get to the dark web. I have so many questions. I'm looking at the clock. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to read the book, and I'm going to get you back on because you're a fascinating guy. For our listeners, how can they connect with you online? You mentioned several free things that you have available on your website. So please, we'll link it in the show notes. But how can our listeners really connect with you online?
You can go to my website, thecareertoolkitbook.com. Now, from there, there's a whole bunch of things for you. Obviously, if you click the buy button, you can see all the places you can buy it and pick it up from your favorite bookstore, online or local. There's a contact page to get in touch with me. The books that I've mentioned, other books I reference in my book, as well as other books that helped me along the way, they're all listed on the resources page, along with some of the free downloads, how to set up one of these peer learning groups at your organization, links to other resources online. All of that is free. Also free, there is an app that goes along with the book. One thing that happens to me when I read books like this is I say, okay, these are some great tips. Oh, good networking tips. Okay, and then I forget 3 weeks later. With the app, you put it on your phone. It's free. It doesn't collect any information. And each day, it's going to pop up a reminder of one of the tips in the book. So you go, oh, right. Okay, I remember that. And that's going to help reinforce what you got out of the book. It's also useful if you're about to go to a networking event or a negotiation. You open it up, and then you can just flip through the tips and kind of do a crash refresher course. And just remind yourself what you got out of the book, and now you're ready to go into that particular event.
Well, brother, it's a ton of value. I can't wait to dive into it because just looking at the synopsis, it just sounds incredibly informational and helpful to people in so many walks of life, especially in the career, obviously. So thank you so much for taking the time, man. I really appreciate it and love what you're bringing out to the world.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, you guys, well, definitely check out Mark's stuff. I think it's incredible. I think you'll get a ton of value out of it. And until next time, you guys continue in transcending life. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much for listening. If this content is delivering value to you, please make sure to subscribe, rate, and review us. That helps us build this community, and that is what we are all about. Building this community as big as we can, helping as many people as we can, and deliver as much value as possible. Be sure to head over to transcendentlifepodcast.com for information on my coaching courses, and make sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Let's Go Win 365. Let's go win and transcend in life.
This is the Transcend in Life podcast with your host, J.M. Ryerson, taking you from fear to freedom.